This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pograin Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
K-pop Demon Hunters, The Game.
Richard Ruane.
Mid-90s Fantasy Film Essentials.
And Benedict Arnold.
Well, I sure am glad President Cat greenlit the Catstronauts' mission to expand the International Space Station. I hear he signed the authorization by swatting a pen across the floor. True leadership right there.
Giant laser pointers in space? What's not to like? And even better, the space station has live stream cameras. Although, half the time it's just nose boops. Let's check how the Catstronauts are doing up there on the space station.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Here comes the kitty technician, Blanket. Careful, Waffles. If he catches you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, then it's back to litter box duty for you.
Wait a second, Robin. Major Meowser just got a hair-raising transmission from HQ. Is that the new napping module on its way?
Yep, it's their first space station edition. Science Officer Pom Pom better know what to do, or there'll be a... catastrophe in 3, 2, 1.
Here she is, and she's sharpening her claws on the instruction manual. Well, it might accidentally flip to the right page with enough swiping, I guess.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady with his prodigious belly. Blanket is swatting at the module's fasteners like a feather toy. Pom Pom finally found the right instructions, and Major Meowser is, napping on them? Teamwork, by golly!
Hooray for the Catstronauts!
The space station is saved!
Until the next module arrives and starts another near catastrophe, that is.
Wow, managing your own space station with a crew of feline heroes. Now that's the life!
You know you can, Robin. The official Catstronauts board game is available now from Atlas Games. It's full of pawsome color art by the comic book's creator, Drew Brockington, and Catstronauts features cooperative play that's fun for all ages. Find out more at atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
Sounds like the Catstronauts board game is perfect for the whole family. Let's meet this stellar challenge by picking up the Catstronauts board game now!
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of, oh, it's delicious kimchi, and the oonce of BTS coming alive. Welcome us into a specially Korean edition of the Gaming Hut, thanks to beloved Patreon backer Justin Moharab, who says... I guess that technically is an ask. He does end it with a question mark, but it's a says. K-pop Demon Hunters. How could it be used as a game? And how would that be a feng shui campaign? Robin, you are the expert of feng shui. I have now seen the K-pop Demon Hunters, so I am as au courant on that as I ever will be. But you are the feng shui guy, so what say you get us started?
Right. And it should be noted for the other listeners that Justin is in my gaming group and he's somewhat lobbying here. For what the next game should be. So, K-pop Demon Hunters, first off, all is a fascinating case of a movie that the people who made it didn't have nearly as much confidence in as the people who found it on Netflix and loved it. And it's, you can't really talk about things on Netflix as being viral, but they don't really promote them. They just drop them and let the algorithm do its work. And this became a big old deal and a great fusion of American animation, some visual language from Japanese anime translated into 3D animation, and of course, a Korean setting, both with its use of boy bands and its use of demonic mythology. And I thought a lot of fun, and I imagine a lot of other people will figure out what to do with it in a game situation as well. And I imagine there are also other rule sets, particularly sort of anime or manga focused ones that might handle this as well. But of course, feng shui is my area of expertise. So that's what we're going to talk about. And so the first question is, do you want it to be a feng shui campaign with a feng shui tone that steals the premise from K-pop demon hunters, or do you actually also want to capture the tone of K-pop demon hunters, which is quite different from feng shui? Korean cinema has some inspiration from Hong Kong cinema, especially the films that inform feng shui are the 90s classics, and those can be kind of harsh in addition to being genre hopping and surprising and weird. And so do you want to apply the full heroic bloodshed rules? In that case, you are taking the premise from K-pop and doing a feng shui game, which of course is much easier.
Yeah.
You right. just do, okay, the premise is a bunch of us or all of us are members of a K-pop band. And instead of taking the chapter that tells you all these locations in Hong Kong, we'll get a travel guide to Seoul and especially the areas and places that are mentioned in the animated film or that are just mentioned in Korean pop cinema in particular. And we're just going to transpose it there. And so that's, you would still have all of the capacity for horror and bloodshed. You could use all the characters who are expert at gun-oriented combat. And there you go. Your game is set in the feng shui setting. You can, obviously, you'll be referencing the underworld a lot, as well as the modern day, but you can bring in all the other different time junctures and the characters that go with them, provided that most of the people have archetypes that correspond to what would fit a band. The tougher thing is to make it feel more like the animated movie, which has wuxia inspired action in it, but it's all blades and you don't see anybody, you know, going down in a rain of gunfire. The horror elements that you would get in an late 80s or early 90s Hong Kong movie are dialed way back, way less gore and stuff. And in that case, I think you'd want to leave out a bunch of the different archetypes. So basically anybody who's proficient in primarily in guns, you either want to just drop those archetypes entirely because there's lots of archetypes in feng shui too. And there's more than enough to do this campaign with, or you reskin them so that the member of the band who's based on the killer is firing energy beams, not with literal two guns blazing, mowing people down with guns, but much more charmingly destroying the demons who just sort of, you know, kind of fall apart in a puff of smoke or whatever it is in a much less violent or disturbing way.
So I agree with you. This is the worthy goal, is to drift feng shui so that it feels like the K-pop Demon Hunters movie. And so that leads to the question of, is there a mechanic or a sub-mechanic in feng shui that you can utilize for Battle of the Bands type music stuff, which is half of the movie? And is there some way to have people fall in love with inappropriate love objects, which is the other half of the movie? And is that in feng shui somewhere? Can you winkle that out?
Well, the second thing is that you're melodramatic hook.
Right.
So you declare up top that, for example, even though you're a demon hunter, you are secretly a demon, or you are susceptible to a brooding boy band member. And so you just do that as your declaration of the plot line you want to follow. And you are encouraged to select melodramatic hooks that somehow relate to that storyline. Or, you know, like the mentor character hiding the fact that you have mentored a demon into being a demon hunter and so forth. And so that's readily enough done. You would need to create a new mechanic to represent a battle of the bands. And I would suggest the chase mechanics. Call the ability singing instead of driving, add that, and with the back and forth of chase is essentially mechanically the same as a music battle.
Yeah.
And I think that would require, again, it's a matter of reskinning. So the next question is, which characters fit where? In the film, the band is three people, which is a manageable number for a full group of players. You'll want to go a little further than that. And I think the next question you ask yourself is, do we want this to be a full band where everybody is in the band? And that is not a problem with K-pop, in which I think there's some of them have like 18 or 19 members. So
yeah, I mean, you can certainly accommodate the average, you know, 5 to 6 person party size in a K-pop band. Absolutely.
Right. One thing that becomes a little tricky is justifying how some archetypes fit into that. So another model you could pick is certain archetypes fit to be band members. And so as you assign the players the task of deciding who they're going to play, part of the arrangement is they have to have at least half of the group has to play members of the band. But then you could also have an entourage. So I think certain of these are better suited or more immediately adapted without changes or particular reskinning into more entourage-y members. So the obvious demon hunter archetypes are the exorcist monk or the more modern magic cop, and also a lot of the sort of older juncture character types you could sort of easily transpose into being band members. And again, it's just sort of a matter of the special effects of the anti-demon attacks they use, because of course they're fighting demons, they're not fighting humans or anything. So you can have your archer, you could use the big bruiser, you could have the big burly member of the band, perhaps the drummer, maybe the bassist. You could have a bodyguard, could be actually a member of the band. Their role is to protect the other members, or you could have that person in the entourage. You could stretch the mythology a bit and have a ghost be a member of the band, perhaps one who fell prey to a previous demon attack, and maybe they're disguising the fact that they're a ghost. That would be a fun melodramatic hook. But a lot of the archetypes you can, you know, just port in as they are now. Sword master, your thief, or your ninja. Everybody wants a stealth person. It's useful to have stealth against demons, so you can put them in the band. Other ones are harder to justify as band members. Like, why would a drifter or a ex-special forces member be an actual singer in the band? Well, they could easily be part of the security team of the entourage. And, you know, every band needs a big-time security team, even when they're not fighting demons.
Right.
But since you've got that already, you've obviously you can do that. There's certain characters who wouldn't fit in the band, like the old master is probably the mentor figure, the producer that might be the head of the record company, might be your manager. The scrappy kid would have to be like a pesky niece or nephew. And you can also introduce other sort of supernatural creatures who are good guys. And that's how you get in your supernatural creature. He could literally just be, you know, a demon, but a good demon. That's part of the plot of K-pop demon hunters, is that they're not all bad. And other ones are getting further afield. How do you justify having a two-fisted archaeologist in your entourage? Well, maybe, you know, obviously since Doug really wants to play the two-fisted archaeologist, well, there's a big archaeological site that is allowing demons to enter the world, and his expertise comes into that. There are some, particularly the futuristic ones, that I think don't fit at all. I don't know how you fit a cyborg or a gene freak or even like a masked avenger or a redeemed pirate from the past. Those don't make a ton of sense as it is. So if you really want to play those characters, especially in the version where you're trying to do the feel of K-pop demon hunters, that's on you, the player, to propose the reskinning of that makes that make sense.
And so for the templates, I know that the point of feng shui is you don't get to jigger the templates around. So is it just that you would pick one skill to replace with singing or music so that everyone has that? And then that's how, you know, you can all be in the chase scene? Or is it just that, you know, the one character is carrying everybody and everyone else's job is just to dance and look pretty?
I think everybody in the band, just right, on top of, okay, what's on the archetype, gets singing 14. And so the question is to, if you're leaning really heavily on the idea of people being in the entourage and not on the band, you have to have other fun things for them to be doing either immediately before and after or during the music battle. But that's a common thing in role playing, right? That,
yeah,
when the magician goes into the astral plane, it's expected that everybody's going to just, you know, hang around and watch briefly while they do their specialty thing, or the cyber guy going into cyberspace. So that's, I think, not necessarily such a huge problem, as long as within the whole scenario, there's something for everybody to do.
And since we know that the demons often do shapeshifting and other chicanery, there's going to be something around the production. You know, we have to protect the, you know, sound mixing board or the lighting or whatever, so the concert goes off, so that our magic can work. And the demons are not just the rival boy band, but they're, you know, sneaking around, you know, charging more money from the facility at the last minute or whatever kind of crisis you, right, can imagine breaking out during a big concert.
A big part of the movie is the relationship of the bands to the fans. And so things that threaten the relationship can be stuff that the other characters do, whether they're, you know, trying to stop some sort of deep fake thing that makes them look bad, or, you know, trying to keep some other third band out of the mess, or there's all sorts of other ways that you can sort of mix that up and keep that going and have as important to be a member of the entourage as a member of the band.
And I suppose before we leave this whole discussion, since we've drifted feng shui a little bit, we should mention the other great band-based role-playing game of Velvet Generation by Rich Rinaldo, which, of course, you would then have to detourn away from starting a revolution and make all of the political actions that your band takes in that game be actually demon hunting actions. And so now that Rich is both delighted that we've mentioned his game and angry that we've pulled its fangs in service to candy-colored K-pop, I feel like that is a good note to go out on, and we'll have an encore after this next beautiful ad. Sinister influences threaten to corrupt America from within and without.
The federal government establishes a new agency for overseas covert action.
The Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, the BNDD.
And within it, the forces of Delta Green.
In the Borealis Connection, the new globe-spanning mega-campaign for the fall of Delta Green, you become the mythos-hunting agents hidden inside the BNDD.
Play 8 linked operations.
As separate standalones.
Or linked into an epic hunt for an infamous target.
Escort a sniper carrying a death warrant for a Shan warlord.
Surveil a Saigon drug summit.
Track heroin couriers on a flight from Hong Kong to L.A.
Investigate the disappearance of an archaeologist working the Bozukepi ceremonial site.
Smash a Beirut drug deal.
ID the actors broadcasting the Necronomicon from a CIA backed Munich radio station.
And wage the drug war amid France's May 68 riots.
Designed by Kenneth Haidt.
Written by Gareth Ryder Hanrahan.
The team that brought you the Zelazny Quartet and the Dracula Dossier.
The Borealis Connection.
Gorgeously designed and horrifically illustrated by Jen McCleary.
A tale of sordid intrigue.
Cosmic horror.
And desperate action against the mythos.
Now available in Titanic hardback.
From specially cleared gaming retail stores.
And the Pelgrane Press web store.
Now also at the web store as an instantly available PDF-only purchase. Welcome back to Ken and or Robin Talk with Someone Else. And today I, Ken, am talking with Richard Ruane, the designer of Moonlight on Roseville Beach and Sherwood. I've looked at Moonlight on Roseville Beach. I decorated the IPR booth at Origins. And
Nice.
I don't know if you've ever been to the IPR booth or any of the listeners have, but it's basically a table full of the most exciting and fun and cool and happening looking games out there, all done by frustrated art majors. And among those wonderful games, Midnight at Roosevelt Beach was one where the cover just really grabbed me. And so that was one of the ones that I picked up and I looked at while I was at the booth. And that alone, I think, is an accomplishment. And then you've also got Sherwood, a whole different sort of a thing.
Very, very different.
Sherwood is, I think that the name explains itself. It's about forest management in modern day Britain. Whereas Moonlight on Roosevelt Beach is a sort of a, I want to say, if there was a cool 90s queer Baywatch nights but with monsters.
Yeah.
That's kind of it, right?
Moonlight on Roosevelt Beach. I think it started sort of with the question of like, what if the spinner racks that used to have those H.P. Lovecraft collections and the Anne Bannon, you know, breakthrough lesbian novels, what if somehow somebody grabbed both of those?
Right.
Like, and that was Moonlight on Roosevelt Beach.
What if those publishers who had those sort of pulp lesbian novels and slightly less prominent pulp homosexual gay novels.
Yeah, yeah.
What if they were somehow on the same spinner rack as the Lovecraft reprints?
And that is frequently how people were buying all those spinner rack stuff, is they just sort of like kind of fold their copy of their Anne Bannon novel or Summer in Sodom just inside, like a horror novel or a Western novel, instead of slip it home.
So I mostly like cowboys, but a little something for the wife, you know?
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that, as a devotee, beloved devotee of mashup culture, you know, spies versus vampires, was it just that, you know, these have common cover design? Was that the spark?
I think it was partially that they sort of had an overlapping sort of pre-bookstore culture where things just ended up on spinner racks just right next to each other. And I think growing up going to used bookstores that still had just sort of those random mishmash and romance exchanges, which is, you know, everywhere, every little town in Texas just had a romance exchange.
Absolutely.
Where you just, you would find
the bookstore was basically a library.
And yeah.
You'd just pay the fee every time you came in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And those things would, the romance exchange in my hometown was like, here's 15 shelves of romance and one shelf of everything else. And so it was really just sort of kind of going back and thinking about sort of that spinner rack culture in which everything just sort of ended up together as sort of like, these are pulps. And frequently not even in a bookstore, frequently just like at a drugstore or at wherever. And so those sort of eventually sort of came together in my mind. The initial conception was a little more Lovecraftian. And as it shifted, it became way less Lovecraftian. But yeah, that's, I think that's really sort of where it's sort of the birthplace of it. And then I moved it up to the 70s because I just found the 70s a really exciting time in queer history. And right before a really tragic time in queer history.
Right, yeah, that's sort of that last great summer.
Yeah, yeah, that very last great summer. One queer novelist had a, you know, it was we remember it because it was the time everyone was still alive. So that was kind of very much where it came from, just that kind of sort of connection.
And also the 70s is sort of the last gasp of that era of book distribution that we're talking about.
Yeah.
But the other commonality over and above, you know, means of production, and this has all been very Marxist of us and we're all good people, but is the notion that queer communities, even the sort of almost open, you know, your province towns, your fire islands, are still subterranean in a way that also monsters and the mythos and black magic are subterranean.
Yeah, if you discover your own sort of Buffy-esque Hellmouth, you can't just move your town.
Right,
Your town is situated where it is.
And you can't go to the cops because they're 90% of your other problems.
Right, yeah. I kind of pick Fire Island and then discover that was where the ACLU took its first queer civil rights case, was cops beating up queer people on the, literally just on the beach.
Right.
And thinking they were going to lose and then get to the New York State Superior Appellate Court and get a statewide victory. But then they unexpectedly won at the Long Island level.
You hate to see it.
Yeah, yeah. They unexpectedly won at the Long Island level because people were so appalled at the police behavior.
Yeah, and that commonality of things that are not, you know, I feel like that is a gigantic reason that people are into Lovecraft or find themselves into Lovecraft is because they're already fans of something or participants in something that conventional society at best goes, well, it's not for me. And more often says that's downright wrong and you shouldn't be doing it. And that's heavy metal, that's comics art, that's pulp fiction, that's all of these scenes or vibes, depending on exactly where we are. And you know, the queer community is a giant part of that, and there have been some very notable queer Lovecraftian writers, Willem Hotfrog Pugmire, most, I think, famous among them, Robert Barlow, obviously, in the ancestral times. Do you think that there is something special about the storytelling possibilities of occult horror or Lovecraftian horror in that, you know, Fire Island-type community that, you know, you're sinking a well where there's more oil, if I want to use that metaphor.
I really want it to feel like a place that could not be easily replaced.
Right.
Because those beach towns, at a time when going there was significantly more affordable in the 70s than it is now, when travel and summer vacation was a lot more affordable, and those towns were much more affordable places than they are now, were a place that queer people from all over the country got to go and meet each other and be around each other in a sort of casual recreational space. So people would come from Texas, they would come from New York City, of course, supplied a big portion of what people going to Fire Island, but also Texas, Oklahoma, all through the Midwest. were able to go there and sort of find a sort of a few weeks of a community that was bigger than the one they had back home.
Right, yeah.
And so I wanted to sort of situate it in a place that felt like a place worth trying to protect. Because I have a warm space in my heart for, I think, what I call sometimes heroic horror. I think a Cabal / Nightbreed kind of fits in there.
Right, yeah.
It's something that, you know, there's a place that you actually want to go to and protect. It's Clive Barker, so it's scary and disturbing, but also a little bit of a Near Dark, where you definitely have the sort of other life you go into and you realize you want to go back to your old one and protect it.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a soft spot in my heart for that sort of horror. I think it sort of helped grow into urban fantasy. Buffy sort of has some roots, some commonalities with that space. But I think for there, it was definitely like, I want this to be situated in a place that is worth not just ditching.
Mm-hmm.
And abandoning.
And it's sort of a lot of the parallels, certainly with things like Trail of Cthulhu, mm-hmm. we do parallels between the Lovecraftian universe and the noir universe, where more you look into things, the worse everything gets.
Yeah.
That's the story of noir.
Mm-hmm.
Don't detect. things are terrible. Stop. But this is the inverse of noir, because, of course, the community is good and to be saved and to be nurtured in a way that Los Angeles in, you know, Philip Marlowe is not. That the Continental Op does not go to Personville to make it better. Mm-hmm. He goes to Personville to destroy it because it's horrible. Mm-hmm. What are the challenges as a designer for trying to encourage that community spirit besides just saying everyone should have community spirit?
I think it's partially, I think one of the things that did very early on is we were experimenting with, you know, some people should just be visiting and other people can be here. Some people are renting for like a week and some people are here, you know, on and off throughout the summer on their long weekends. And some people are working here. And we really wanted to shift it to everyone is working there.
Right.
For a lot of different reasons, but also because that just means that you are situated in that space for a while.
Right.
Another challenge is we don't want to pretend that queer communities don't have trouble, bad
Ruction.
People.
Yeah, bad actors.
Bad actors, people who act as bad actors, even though they can be, they are not always. There's complexity among queer people. So we don't want to have that world where, like, it's just like every gay person is good. But, you know, lots of people come here. So we can't just be like, oh, there's some awful real estate developers around the corner. Guess it's time to go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Is there a mechanical element in the game that
I feel like
supports
it's
that?
Heavily fiction-driven in the fact that you are working there for the summer.
Right.
For several of the character origin stories, you're going, there's not a home to go to, really.
Yeah, right.
There's I think several people have scandals in their backgrounds. Other people are just kind of coming out. This is their first summer around queer people. So it's just not a matter of turning around and going back home or moving on to someplace else. Yeah,
the challenge of the cozy horror is one that is in every medium. It's a tough corner to turn.
Yeah.
And I think that Moonlight at Roosevelt Beach does it as well as anyone has done it. But I'm always interested because I feel like areas that as designers we neglect are things like community.
Yeah.
And things like, sure, you stabbed an ogre. Good for you. That ogre needed stabbing. No one denies it. But what are you doing that's good and worthwhile? In Pendragon, you're at least having kids. You know, you're passing them on. In Ray Winninger's Underground, you're giving up your experience points to get, you know, that light bulb replaced in the streetlight or whatever. But most games are basically predatory or parasitical. And that's
right,
just the nature of the universe. And it's very hard to design a game that isn't. And so when someone's trying to do that, I'm always curious as to, are you moving forward into that space? Do you look at games like Moonlight or games like Yaziva's Bed and Breakfast and you say, this is a very open, interesting, fertile field to explore as a game designer? Or are you now like, well, I've done that. I'm now going to go on and do my Starship game or whatever. Not Jefferson Starship, one of the actual Starships.
You know, Jefferson Starship would be a great game.
It would be an interesting game, especially when you make that mid-game turn and everything has to suck.
I'm glad we're on the same page on that one. I think right now what I'm working on is a werewolf-focused game. It's built on Chris McDowell's Into the Odd as sort of mechanical structure, but the fiction structure is that werewolves tend to situate themselves very heavily focused on a particular town,
right,
where they protect particular people, because that's the only way you keep your town, even if you don't have heroic intentions towards individuals, if you just don't protect your town, then other people move in and sort of like get on top
right.
of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're sort of doing a series of towns that each have crises in them. My contribution to this
kind almost of werewolves in the vineyard, it sounds like.
Werewolves, yeah, is built on a fictional model of Brant, Texas, which is a weird little West Texas town that I discovered because I used to be going between Abilene and San Angelo a lot. And Brant is the only town that's on that little highway. And so I sort of built that kind of community around Brant and put a pack in Brant and called it Hattie instead. But that was very, very interested in what happens when people situate themselves in place. And I think that part of that was my favorite game for a long time was Beyond the Wall and Other Adventures, an OSR mm-hmm. game. Unlike OSR games where you're just like, oh, you meet in a tavern and you go out in the world, it's all you grew up together, you know each other, and somebody's attacking the town you grew up in.
Right.
The village, yeah.
Yeah. And so there's that built-in set of stakes.
Right. There's a built-in set of stakes that are not heavily mechanically enforced, but in the setup, players really end up buying into them without necessarily having mechanics.
Yeah, it is surprising how much just giving you one line to fill out on your character sheet suddenly just sort of creates mm-hmm. these sorts of ties in play.
Yeah.
Talking about character sheets, fill in a little of your character sheet. What brought you from, one hopes, a decent upstanding member of your community to the degenerate art of role-playing game design?
Well, I, growing up a Baptist pastor's kid, grew up really kind of enjoying D&D, but my group was really focused on Champions, and we really sort of dug into Champions. And then
you're a Baptist pastor's kid in Texas. You better not be playing D&D.
No, yeah. That was way easier to sell to my folks. And, grew up playing a lot of Champions, a lot of AD&D, dropped out for a long time and came back for World of Darkness, mm-hmm. and was a huge World of Darkness fan for a long, long time. Did a short stint as a freelance editor, occasional writer for White Wolf, back in 99-2000, mm-hmm. and discovered how well that paid.
Yeah. I think a lot of people discovered that at roughly the same time.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, I'm never going to get my CIFWA membership on this. And then I left, did a little bit of work in alternative comics, went back to grad school, which, you know, what was that about? And did some work in educational media in about 2014, working with a friend at a game store, just as where I had just been an attendee and a GM, asked me to write some adventures for a gap in the organized play program she was running. And that sort of reignited my my love of kind of writing in the space, and then just sort of slowly came back into it, did some stuff in Gauntlet Codex, and then started doing my own stuff in 2020 and opened Aurok Studios then. So
right. Yeah. And Aurok Studios is basically
My imprint.
Your imprint.
Yeah.
Your corporate shell.
Yeah, my corporate. Yeah. My fake identity.
And your fake ID.
Yeah.
To get into those bars in Roosevelt Beach.
Yeah.
Can people find you, your new fans and your old fans?
Oh, yeah.
Tell them where they can find you.
I am at r-rook.studio, and I do a lot of work with +1EXP, and that's +1EXP.com.
Right.
Or my personal site, r-rook.studio. So that's
fantastic. And you're, are you active on any social media that people can follow you on?
I am in Blue Sky, where just no dashes or spaces, just rook studio.
Okay, fantastic. You've heard it from the mouth of the creator himself. Werewolves coming to protect small towns, possibly against their will. The game that we've been talking about is Moonlight at Roosevelt Beach. I feel a little unfair to Sherwood, but I really, you know, it's a great little Robin Hood game, but I feel like we all kind of know what that is and need a little less unpacking. But if you're in the market for a great little Robin Hood game, Richard also has one of those. So thank you so much for coming on the show. Thanks for talking about Moonlight at Roosevelt Beach. Thanks for putting up with my sort of divagations and nonsense into noir and everything else.
No, thank you.
But it's always super fun to talk to someone who's designed something that found a thing to do in this art form, even in a fairly crowded sub-niche of the art form, and do it in a cool, interesting, new, fresh way. And that's what lets me know this is an art form and not just a whole bunch of people Xeroxing dungeons onto graph paper. So thank you so much, Richard, for coming out, for talking about your games, and for being part of the program.
Thank you so much.
caught in the spiral.
Four scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral and the Delta Green Campaign, God's Teeth.
That span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
And must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green, God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Protect this podcast from swoony demon boy bands, alongside such beloved Patreon backers as
Omen Gonzalez,
Dan O'Hanlon,
Eric Parks,
Eric Lauren,
and Evan Hughes. It's time once more to stroll into the 1990s cinema. It's a freestanding one. There's some cineplexes, but we're going to go into one of the big halls, perhaps the ones that have closed on St. Clair Avenue. We're going to grab our popcorn. We're going to sit down for some mid-90s fantasy film essentials. Last time around, everything was from 1991. Now things are spacing out again a little more, but there's a thread of similarities between them, almost as if we're starting to hit cycles. We're starting to repeat. We're starting to loop, which brings us, Ken, to a film which has such great impact that it's created its own subgenre.
Yes, and that subgenre is the time loop film, the greatest of which, and among the greatest fantasy movies ever made, and among the greatest comedies ever made, is Harold Ramis' second best movie, Groundhog Day, from 1993, starring the immortal Bill Murray as Phil Connors, a weatherman who is sent to Punxsutawney to cover the annual unveiling of the groundhog. Punxsutawney Phil, whether or not he sees his shadow, he thinks this is stupid. He's above all this nonsense. He hates Punxsutawney. He hates this job. And of course, that means
that he hates himself and everyone else. And it's a grouch.
And he hates himself and everyone else. And that, of course, means that that is the day that he is condemned to live over and over again. Andy McDowell plays Rita Hansen. The only interesting thing in his life, and he has to sort of learn that she is also a love interest and what that means. And then there's a mini murderer's row of character actors, Chris Elliott as the cameraman, Stephen Tobolowsky, Brian Doyle Murray. It's just a beautifully populated film, which it would have to be since you're spending the whole movie seeing these same people do their same shtick over and over and over again. And the casting, I feel, is a undersung part of this after, of course, everyone loving Bill Murray.
Yeah, so the time loop plot line immediately caught on. So it's something that becomes more often immediately afterwards got ripped off in episodic television. And then more recently, there's been a whole spate of different, well, we're just going to do time loop movies. So there's slasher time loops. There's weirder rom-com time loops. There's a whole bunch of them. And you sort of think, oh, well, yeah, this has been a thing forever. It's only been a thing since Harold Ramis and his co-screenwriter thought it up in 1993. And this is one of those, as you suggest, just a perfectly executed screen comedies and one of the great fantasy films of all time.
And still in 1993, and as we record this episode, we're heading into Halloween. And as you're listening to it, if you're listening to it right as it drops, you are heading even more into Halloween, which of course means that we are all thinking of Christmas, or at least we all are if we run department stores. And specifically, we're thinking of The Nightmare Before Christmas, 1993, directed by Henry Selick. And I suspect you can win the occasional bet in a bar over who directed Nightmare Before Christmas, because it is called Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas. He wrote it and he co-produced it, and it has Tim Burton's sensibility all through it, not least in the Danny Elfman music. And Danny Elfman is also the singing voice of Jack Skellington, the beloved mayor of Halloween Town, who has decided that it should always be Halloween, and therefore he should kidnap Santa. Chris Sarandon, again, talk about your loaded voice cast, Chris Sarandon, Catherine O'Hara, Glenn Shaddix, back from Beetlejuice as the mayor, Paul Rubens. It's just on and on and on and on, and it is one of the most infectiously rollicking animated musicals of the 90s, and that is definitely saying something. And in fact, I am forbidden from putting any of the songs on in October because it will stick in Sheila's head for the next 2 weeks, and she doesn't want to hear me discussing the fact that this is Halloween. This is Halloween. This is Halloween for the next 2 weeks. So that is the power of that movie, and it is an unadorned delight. I, you know, like any good sort of YA or kid aiming movie, it is scary and weird and messed up, and it is also endlessly delightful and charming and wild at the same time. And, you know, there's nothing you can say about it in terms of nitpicking or finding fault. It sets up its wonderful little fairy tale holiday universe. It plays true to its own rules, but its own rules are strange enough that at no point does it become formulaic. And even though you know, of course, that Jack Skellington is going to learn his lesson and everything's going to come out all right because it is Burton and because of the sort of originality of the premise, you're not absolutely sure everything's going to come out right. And that is the frisson that makes The Nightmare Before Christmas work.
It's pitched at somewhat older kids than your standard animated film, which is good. Those kids need movies too. It's a little intense for very younger kids. And for that reason, and just for its general weirdness, Disney was sufficiently nervous about this. They had almost no confidence in this. And in fact, they release it not under the Disney label, but under their Touchstone sub imprint, which was created to create a distinction between their animated films. And then they went, this animated film is too weird. We don't believe in it. Let's make it a Touchstone. Of course, the story turns out to be much different, and it was a big hit at the time. It's still a merchandising juggernaut, and every bit deserves the reputation that it continues. There's still live performances of it. The Hollywood Bowl, I think every Christmas does it with some of the original voice cast. So it definitely deserves its place in the dark fantasy pantheon. And speaking of animated films and pantheons, Ken, what's next on our list?
What's next on our list? We can finally get to 1995, and we are getting to a movie that established, I mean, there's other movies in which toys come to life. This goes all the way back, but this is the movie in which toys coming to life, you know, they get their The Searchers, they get their Casablanca, they get their masterpiece of a toys coming to life story. The Toy Story, a trilogy, the first one directed by John Lasseter, is, in my estimation, one of the great movie trilogies of all time, full stop. It is just, I don't have anything particularly against any of the later stuff, but the first three are a perfect trilogy. And in many ways, better, I would say, than many beloved trilogies, because none of them come apart. Tom Hanks is Woody. He's a toy cowboy. He is the beloved friend of his boy who owns and plays with him, Andy. And when Andy gets a new toy, the exciting Buzz Lightyear spaceman toy, voiced by Tim Allen, in a wonderful piece of characterization, possibly following on from Galaxy Quest, he moved that spaceship captain into the next level. And that sets up the rivalry for the loyalty and allegiance of the various toys, played again by a, this is absolutely Disney system, where they went and they found every great character actor and said, do your voice. And Don Rickles, of course, Mr. Potato Head, Jim Varney, the Slinky Dog, Wallace Shawn, the toy Tyrannosaur, John Ratzenberger as the toy pig, Annie Potts is Bo Peep, and Art Lee Ermey is one of the tiny army men. And again, there's, you know, This is not the place to go into small soldiers, which is more horror than fantasy, but it's a great concept, and they do it well and show a great deal of good love to that film as well. And it is just a great story. It's a great concept. The toys can only move around when there's no humans watching them. So that sets up a wonderful, a magic rule that is very easily understood and immediately obvious. And then a lot of it is just following through on those consequences, as well as the sort of miniature people trying to manipulate grown-up sized things storyline that goes back to the Borrowers and, you know, early kids fiction. And again, something that I think every kid in the world loves to watch, because they also are miniature people who are trying to manipulate big world things. And once more, maybe they feel like they can't really come alive and be themselves when they have to sort of obey their parents and pay attention. But when it's just them and their toys, everything is cool. It sort of drills down as deep as you want to go while still never being psychoanalytical or obvious or any of the other things that that this storyline could easily have drifted into. It's a beautiful adventure story driven by a perfectly sound character drama that happens to star a bunch of toys.
Right. It's based on the emotional through line is very strong, right? It's about the fear of being eclipsed and replaced and rejected. So there's a real emotional core there. So this is a landmark film in a couple of ways. First of all, this is one where Pixar comes into its own and becomes a force to be reckoned with, one that starts to rival Disney. This is before Disney owns them. And it is also the dawn of the let's cast gigantic movie stars in the voice roles. So the Disney classics that we looked at, Robin Williams is in there. He's sort of the biggest example of a casting choice until now. But here we've got Tom Hanks, Tim Allen at the height of their stardom, and Don Rickles aside. And even he's sort of an interesting choice because he's not a cuddly voice that would have been on the Borscht Belt circuit, but he's a little edgier. But now we've got voice talent coming in from major television shows and stuff. And so the voices are much more recognizable, and they're recognizable as the people playing them. And those two things together, the advent of Pixar and the superstar casting of voices, become a thread that continues to this day. Now we're going to stay within the realm of animation, but move back into stop motion. Henry Selick again, this time not with Tim Burton, but teaming with the work of Roald Dahl, does James and the Giant Peach from 1996. And this is your classic kids theme of a orphan kid being mistreated by adults and having to escape them in the way that young James, voiced by Paul Terry, has to escape. He's got evil aunts looking after him, voiced by Joanna Lumley and Miriam Margolyes, and he wants to get away from them. And so magic is worked upon a tree. A peach grows to giant size. On the giant peach are human-sized insects, voiced by Simon Callow, Richard Dreyfuss, Susan Sarandon, and David Thewlis, and they are all as bizarre as anything out of Nightmare Before Christmas in their appearance. There's a great journey, there's an epic quest, and the kid ultimately, after one final brush with danger with evil ants, is rescued and gets the new home that he deserves. So it's a great fusion of the weird darkness of Roald Dahl fused with Selick's great sense of design and characterization. The robot shark in particular is a brilliant little piece of design. And so this is less epically famous than the other ones we've been talking about, but definitely also a must see.
Yeah. And Roald Dahl keeps, despite every attempt by the culture to move past, forget, ignore, put on a shelf, Roald Dahl, sadly or happily, he continues to appeal to actual children always and everywhere. And James and the Giant Peach, I think I saw it maybe too old to be appealed to in the way that I should. I liked it a lot. I think it's a terrific movie, as you say, but it would not have immediately sprung to the front of my mind in the way that the other three that we talked about, which were all, of course, gigantic hits. But this is a truly great movie and well worth seeing. And the thread of Roald Dahl should always be maintained by right-thinking people.
Finally, for the last one this time around, I get to move back to the realm of international cinema and one of my very favorite films of all time by one of my favorite directors, Afterlife by Hirokazu Koreeda from Japan. This has some parallels to Defending Your Life in that it depicts the afterlife as a bureaucracy that is strangely mundane. But in this case, it's sort of a beautiful, comforting bureaucracy, because when you die, it turns out that you resurface in these sort of anodyne kind of office buildings. And there's a crew of people who quiz you about the single memory that you most want to experience for the rest of your afterlife. And people have time to think about it. They're quizzed by the staff. They're prodded along. Some think of it easily. Some aren't sure what they want to do. And finally, at the end of this process, the team of unspecified celestial bureaucrats, workers, creates a beautiful little home movie with Homecraft style special effects, and that marks your passage into your beautiful afterlife where you will forever interact with this dream memory. And it is just charming and beautiful and magical in a way that you can't force. It's just done so beautifully and is, again, like I said, just one of my favorite films, period, let alone one of my favorite fantasy films.
Well, I have not seen Afterlife, so as with so many matters of international cinema, I shall merely nod sagely and reach for more popcorn. But we're out of popcorn, which must mean that we're out of this hut and into a beloved commercial.
The British are coming! The British are coming!
In Flagbearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated in Nations and Cannons, you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The new campaign guide, The American Crisis, War in the North, covers the early actions of the war with historical adventures, setting information, and a fiendish Hessian plot.
Nations and Cannons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
Educators can get a copy of the core book for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The American Crisis is now fully available in print as well as PDF.
Visit nationsandcannons.com to check out a free adventure chapter and the quick start guide.
The whirring of chronotons and the clacking of time gears tells we're once more standing in proximity to Ken's time machine. This, of course, is the conveyance that Ken's superiors at Time Incorporated provide to him so that he may go back into history to spend, fold, spindle, and sometimes, yes, even mutilate it. And this time around, beloved Patreon backer Mark Kenny says this: Benedict Arnold was one of the most talented and energetic American commanders in the early years of the Revolution. Is there any way to arrange events so he doesn't succumb to his ambition and wounded vanity and end up betraying the cause he championed? Does changing that have any other impact on the timeline?
Everything that Mark Kenny says is correct. Benedict Arnold is from a long line of colonial officials in Connecticut. His grandfather, I believe, was one of the first governors of Connecticut. He is born in 1741 in Norwich, Connecticut. He eventually becomes a merchant. His father basically drank away the family fortune, so he had to start all over again. He hates the Sugar and Stamp Acts, which basically do nothing but interfere with mercantile business. So he joins the Sons of Liberty. Once the war breaks out, gets elected a captain of Connecticut militia and goes to the Siege of Boston, hangs around, is not temperamentally suited for siege warfare. So he gets a commission from the Massachusetts Committee of Public Safety to go up and seize Fort Ticonderoga. He's basically telling everyone he meets, Fort Ticonderoga is desperately under-defended. There's no garrison there. Let's go take it. And finally, someone calls his bluff and sends him up with basically no men to seize Fort Ty. Fortunately, beloved mountain man Ethan Allen is also trying to take Fort Ticonderoga, but if he did it, it would basically just be an act of piracy. So they sort of fall on Benedict Arnold to give them legal cover. And sure enough, Fort Ty is basically undefended and it falls. On his way back from Fort Ty, his first wife dies. On the basis of that, and he has already begun making friends and influencing people, he comes back to Massachusetts and he says, "See, I was right." And they're like, "Well, you were right that Ethan Allen helped you." And he says, "Ethan Allen did nothing." And that, of course, gets back to Ethan Allen. And so it's a big thing. He is incapable constitutionally of taking a compliment. And he is the worst politician ever. And when you're just a militia captain, it doesn't matter. But George Washington says, oh, look, someone who can actually do things, and makes him a colonel in the Continental Army. And he says, what else is undefended, Benedict Arnold? He says, Quebec. And Washington says, okay, go tell Congress that you want to take Quebec. And he goes, tell Congress. And they said, that's a good point. We're going to make an entirely different person the general in charge of taking Quebec, Montgomery. And he gets mad and goes back to Washington and complains and says, I want to lead a second wing of the assault on Quebec. And Washington says, great, I'm excited to hear it. How are you going to do it? And he says, we're going to go through Maine, trackless Maine with no roads. And we're just going to take canoes all the way up to Quebec. And Washington at this point is saying, well, I do like energy in my subordinates, gives the plan his blessing. Arnold starts with 400 men, you would think not enough to take Quebec, and winds up with 200 men at the other end of that trip, but he does get them all the way through Maine and above the heights of Quebec, just about when Montgomery is showing up. And so they mount a attack in a blizzard, which manages to conceal their minuscule numbers and let them get into the city. But the trouble is the blizzard also prevents them from advancing as far as they need to advance to take the strategic points. The British garrison wakes up. Montgomery is killed on a street climbing up to the citadel. With Montgomery's death, the battle basically comes apart. Arnold beats a fighting retreat, maintains Quebec under siege is a strong word, but there's a ring of Americans outside Quebec until the British army shows up. And then he moves back south via Lake Champlain, where in 1776, he notes that the whole British army is coming south on Lake Champlain. And so he builds a navy on Lake Champlain to harass the British army. And the British army then has to stop and build their own navy, which they do. And they finally sweep Benedict Arnold out of the way in October of 1776, by which time it's too late for the invasion to work. So he has basically given the colonies a whole year of survival from this British army that was going to come down and stomp on them. In 1777, Washington sends him to defend Rhode Island. But once more, he doesn't like sitting around, so he attacks the British in Connecticut. They're foraging parties. This is very impressive. Washington recommends him for promotion to major general. But as I mentioned previously, he has made everyone mad at him. And so Congress, which didn't like him when he was talking about Quebec, and certainly didn't like him showing them up by doing his own Quebec thing, doesn't bother promoting him. And Washington personally intervenes, demands a promotion for him, and he's sent north to Saratoga to reinforce Horatio Gates, who is the general in charge of resisting the second British invasion. And Gates is a incompetent gladhander, and so Arnold basically leaves Gates to command the troops and goes off to a place called Bemis Heights, where he says, we should seize Bemis Heights. It'll stop the British. And Gates is like, it's not my idea. I hate it. And I hate you. But he does it anyway. Again, does not endear himself to command authority. But that is, in fact, what is the important part of the battle. He suffers a horrendous leg wound, right where he also got a leg wound in the siege of Quebec.
Right. And this leg wound has a great historical footnote, as it were. I did not plan that.
Right.
In that in 1887, in Saratoga National Park, people pay tribute to the heroism of this now unspecified military commander, and they have the boot monument. So it's a monument to his leg. Yeah. He's not mentioned by name as the victor who left parts of his leg on the battlefield, but it's celebrated nonetheless in one of military history's more amusingly odd monuments.
Yes. So the British surrender at Saratoga, and Arnold immediately starts undermining Gates, which again makes Gates mad, and it makes all of Gates' sponsors in Congress mad, because, of course, the reason he got the job is he's beloved in Congress. And so Washington, in a moment of perhaps poor judgment, or I would say in a moment of definitely poor judgment, makes Arnold the military commander of Philadelphia. So he basically gets to sit and tell Congress no, or demand more help from Congress on alternate days, makes tons of more political enemies. He gets embroiled in money schemes because, of course, we need to supply my troops. I'm going to buy a share in this, you know, horse stable or this forage company. And then when I'm supplying my troops, I'm putting money in my own pocket. And everyone getting madder and madder at him. He desperately needs money. He's hanging out with the rich people in Philadelphia, many of whom are Tories and were flourishing under the recent British occupation. And one of the Tories that he meets is a hot 18-year-old woman named Dorothy Shippen, and her dad is a big Tory, full of money, and Dorothy has everything that Benedict Arnold wants in life, especially money. And so in 1779, he has already begun treasonous communication with General Clinton in New York, the British commander, and saying, just hypothetically, if a major general were to go over to the British, what kind of money would that generate, do you think? And he marries Dorothy Shippen, and right around that time, he starts getting court-martialed for all of his corruption, which any other general would have gotten away with. It was very accepted sort of behavior, but he had tons and tons of enemies who hated him. And also, by that time, Congress was feeling secure enough that they could start doing a little ideological purging of various Tory factions in Philadelphia. And so his new in-laws are getting, you know, hassled by mobs and politicians. It's a bad scene. He's cleared of his court-martial in 1780, and Washington is looking around to get him out of politics. And he says, West Point, the strategic key to the Hudson Valley, we're going to put you in command of it. You can bring your wife. She'll be out of Philadelphia. Everyone will be happy. Except, of course, that by now he's in complete correspondence with the British. They're just haggling over money. They finally agree for a payment of £20,000, which is about 3.3 million pounds in today's money. And the guy who's bringing the agreement letter to General Clinton gets caught by the Americans. And that is John Andre, who, by the way, is his wife's ex. Interesting point there. And John Andre gives up the goods. They find the Arnold's letters. Arnold realizes the gaffe is up when he hears that Andre has been taken and says, you guys hold the fort, which, by the way, he's been systematically reducing in readiness. I'm going to go sail out to the Hudson and check stuff out. And he instead sails to the British man of war Vulture, climbs aboard and says, take me to New York. I need to talk to General Clinton. General Clinton makes him a brigadier general in the British service, but they say 2/3 of your money was for West Point. You didn't give us West Point, so you only get £6,000, and count yourself lucky. So in 1781, as a British brigadier, he raids Virginia and Connecticut. In every case, Washington gives orders that if he is captured, he is to be hung without trial. And this inspires local militias to hate him even more. He flees for England finally because he is unable to mount raids because everyone, you know, rats him out. And once he gets to England, A, the Whigs are in power, and B, even the Tories won't give him jobs because he's a traitor. And they're like, that's the stink of betrayal. We don't want you. Even in India, he can't get a job. He tries to do that. So in 1785, he moves back to the Americas, specifically New Brunswick in Canada, where he makes ever more enemies, gets in ever more lawsuits. In 1792, he is a privateer in the Caribbean, and he's captured by the French while he's trying to sack Guadeloupe, the sugar island, but he bribes his jailers to let him go. So we almost had him hung in 1792 by the French revolutionaries, which would have been great. He goes back to London, and his leg keeps giving him problems. He's got gout by now, and he dies of dropsy in 1801 at the age of 60. A hissing and a byword on two continents.
Right. So whatever the time intervention is, we're not sure necessarily that it would lay his ghost to rest, because his ghost is said by people who do ghost tours to visit his mother's grave in Norwich every Halloween on a white horse. And he must get off the horse to walk over to the grave because you can see his limp.
Yes.
Which, of course, it identifies whose ghost you're looking at.
Yeah, surgery left his left leg 2 inches shorter than his right leg after the wound at Saratoga.
Right, so still noticeable even on his ghost.
Even in his ghost.
Yeah. The house he was raised in was considered haunted and was a locus for misfortune. Everybody who lived there had a bad time. So maybe he's, I don't know, maybe you're going to lift a curse, Ken. It was torn down after it was struck by lightning in 1855. Even lightning didn't like his house.
Yep. God hates Benedict Arnold. This is well known.
So it seems like the problem here is personality transplant. How are you going to help him out here?
The big problem happens when he's in Philadelphia with nothing to do militarily except fight with Congress and date Tories. And between those two things, he is constantly reminded that everyone in Congress hates him, that he's never going to get another promotion without the explicit word of George Washington. He finally gets his seniority back, but Congress says the seniority is just for your recent heroism. We did nothing wrong denying you your seniority. Far from it. If we could get away with it, we wouldn't do it. And he feels that that's mean. So don't put him in Philadelphia. This seems like the logical answer. There is another general who is at Saratoga, also wounded, also has 2 inches taken out of his leg, a guy named Benjamin Lincoln. And Benjamin Lincoln is the guy who Washington sends south to command the Continental Army in the South in 1778. And Benjamin Lincoln, fun fact, surrenders the largest single American army surrendered in the war when the British take Charleston out from under him. That's in 1779. And Benjamin Lincoln, obviously not good at the actual fighting the British part of the war. He was actually pretty good at sort of logistics and lots of, you know, raising militia, the sort of, and very good at getting along with Congress, although he was mad that Arnold got his seniority promoted over him. So Lincoln and Arnold already hate each other. So leave Lincoln in Philadelphia. He's a nice guy. Everyone gets along with Lincoln. Plus, as far as we know, he doesn't want to date Tories. I think he's married even. Benedict Arnold can go to the South. And Benedict Arnold, put in charge of retaking Savannah. I mean, if he attacks Quebec with 200 guys all dying of dysentery after coming out of Maine, he will definitely attack the British fort in Savannah and take it, even if the French do their traditional half-assed job of helping out. And his defense of Charleston will not be reduced to, I'm going to sit there and wait and let the militia do all of the outside work. Again, when Benjamin Lincoln surrenders Charleston, he does let the militia escape, but, you know, that is at the very least a mitigating circumstance. I don't feel like Arnold would have been caught in a trap like Lincoln was. He's a fighting general, and he's always looking to sort of flank his opponent and go in a way that they're not looking. And that's exactly what it turns out you need in the South, because after Lincoln gets caught in a box, the command goes to Nathaniel Greene, who was exactly that kind of improvisatory general that you need to command the South. And so Arnold in command of the South, I think, would have done a better job than Benjamin Lincoln, couldn't have done a worse job, and would not be around doe-eyed Tories with their winning ways. And so maybe he would have married a nice patriot girl and gotten over that, and would maybe have wound up being, I don't know, governor of Connecticut, or maybe even Secretary of War. Lincoln eventually became Secretary of War under the Continental Congress. In no universe would Congress have appointed Benedict Arnold Secretary of War, but you can imagine a world in which George Washington appoints him Secretary of War. And then, you know, the difference is not that much, because we still win the war with or without Charleston. But the difference is lots more Benedicts being born in America. It's not just Cumberbatches over there. Lots of, you know, Arnoldsvilles and Arnoldsburgs. There's probably a big American city somewhere called Arnoldsville or Arnold City, and lots of Benedict counties and Arnold counties. So he would have been a gigantic hero. Maybe Lin-Manuel Miranda would have done a musical about him, because he was the guy who was always... You get a monument
that's more than just his leg.
More than just his leg. His whole body is at Saratoga in statue form, because he's the bitter guy that's always passed over, but he winds up saving the revolution. And that would be a compelling story, I think, in a lot of ways too. So who can say? I don't think that there's a way that, you know, you get Florida taken early. I think that's sort of on the outside realm of possibility. We did try to invade East Florida and take Pensacola from the British a couple of times. Maybe if Arnold overwhelmingly wins at Savannah, he might have attacked Pensacola. So maybe we get East Florida before Andy Jackson takes it away from the Spanish in 1819. But I don't know that that's a gigantic difference. But maybe Florida has 2 states. Maybe that's the big difference, is we have East Florida and West Florida now.
So it's even easier for us now to gamify your Revolutionary War segments. It's Play This with Nations and Cannons, our delightful new sponsor.
Exactly.
We drifted along to the alternate reality where Benedict Arnold is still remembered as a hero, or you can just play the real history out with all of the added superpowers and stuff that rule set gives you. So I feel that our work on that end is done.
Yeah, I mean, the story of John Andre getting intercepted is one of the great you know, scenarios already in the Revolution. And if you can work that around so that you're maybe having a chance to magically purge Arnold of his evil, who wouldn't want to do that? But I think the better way is to get him as far away from Congress as physically possible, send him to Georgia in 1779.
Well, on that conclusive note, it's time for us to conclude this podcast, but we'll be back with another one a mere week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dork Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Protect this podcast from infamous betrayal by joining such backers as
Ian Nystrom.
Robert Dean.
Jason Sullivan.
Brian K. Eason.
And Joshua Randall.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.